You'll see it there, staterepcarolammons.com, or you can find me on Facebook.
Springfield and Duncan.
Yeah. Also, just to remind you that this Monday, the nursing home forum is going to be held at Brookings at 6:30 p.m., March 6th at 6:30. It'll be a presentation from the county administrator folks, but we definitely want people to be in the house on that on this Monday at 6:30. And, of course, you can always join the Urbana City Council this Monday at Urbana 400 South Vine Street. Brother Aaron will be there, as well as others working on issues in Urbana. This is my show. I'm gonna let A-Dub close out his show. Then go for it.
So listen,
I took a minute or two earlier.
As John Lee Johnson would say when he was doing Higher Ground, why don't y'all stay out of trouble? But as Paul Muse likes to say, and I agree, why don't you get in the right kind of trouble?
There you go.
Peace and much love to
peace
you.
Peace and much love. Thank you so much.
To the nursing home forum, I guess the. Care.
All right. Oh, so is in solidarity
purple?
With
so, Aspen. So SEIU people can. And wear their purple garments.
Absolutely not. Okay, I got you.
Gotcha.
I still need to get that hoodie. My purple hoodie. Congratulations on the contract.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Standing pretty tough.
Yes, indeed.
I've been talking. My years in the SEIU, I was always noting how, and I think we talked off the air about this a couple weeks ago, actually, but the so-called campus-wide raise.
Yeah,
when I was working, we never got it. We always got an increment below. So I talked to a business agent of the union and said, why don't we run those numbers? I don't do spreadsheets very well, but look at how much that raise that we didn't get from the campus-wide raise would be compounded over the years, you know, if people are getting my drift. Don't get no respect. It's about time. Anyway, yeah, have a great day. All right, a couple minutes in and got a lot of stuff as usual. More than I can handle. It's a little hard these days to decide what to feature. I've got some short features in the front, and I'll be doing some more of these PSAs. There's a WEFT benefit tonight. I don't know if I'll have a sample of Chickadee Sermon. Rainbow Flag. I should have picked up some of their stuff as well. I've recorded them. And Mike Feldman, who is the recordist extraordinaire, is going to be presenting some music. And that's at 1002 South Anderson. That's Anderson and Washington, I guess, from 7 to 10 tonight. This will be a relaxed place to listen to some great music, meet some people, and support WEFT. You can find more information at the WEFT WEFT website or the Facebook event page. Look for Soundhouse. It'll come up. And so, like I said, I got some of the regular features. Bruce Dixon of Black Agenda Report, who I haven't heard from in a while. I'm going to kick it off. Amy Goodman. I guess I'll play both the short take from Mumia Abu-Jamal, too. And got something from the... Intercepted, which is the project of Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill and now Naomi Klein's contributing, some kind of press about one of their writers or something. I haven't followed it down yet, but they have a lot of people that work for The Intercept. I recommend it to you. Glenn Greenwald's essays are coming thick and fast and very incisive. But I had also a piece from about Berta Caceres. This week was the anniversary of her assassination. There's more stuff coming out about U.S. role in this Honduran hit. And Amy Goodman covered it and then had a part two web exclusive. So I'm just going to mention that. I won't probably have time to get to it. Gareth Porter's busy as well. He's one of my go-to guys. He did an interview with Pacifica Houston, a regular producer down there. I think I'll probably end up just playing a sample of that and more about it tomorrow. It's about the White Helmets, who are got the alternative Nobel Prize and got quite a few accolades in Hollywood with the documentary. And it's a difficult situation and kind of difficult to talk about in a lot of ways, but... one of their producers down in Pacifica and Gareth Porter got together to discuss some of the antecedents to the White Helmets that you might not know about. Got a little bit on tax justice. I've been talking about this program from Richard Wolf called Economic Update. It'd be great to have some regularly featured economics in the mix. Remember when I used to play the short update of the week's economic news from Doug Henwood, but he's moving around in the schedule, and he doesn't really do that anymore. He's much more wide-ranging than he has been in the past as far as being just on economics. He's got a new interview with the finance guy from the Syriza party in Greece, updating on a lot of different things, I think. If you want to look into some international economics from a left business observer point of view. All right, with all of that as a prelude, let's get to some of these features. I think, did I mention all of them? I believe so. But let's kick it off with Bruce Dixon, since we haven't heard from him in a while. He's a Chicago native who now lives in Atlanta and is associated with the Green Party down there, actually.
Black folks with nothing better to do were up in arms for a whole day about Kellyanne Conway's feet buried in the Oval Office sofa messing with her phone while the presidents and chancellors of historically black colleges and universities crowded around Donald Trump's desk. Some others have written about Betsy DeVos's note on HBCUs, which revealed her stunning and self-serving ignorance of their history and origin. But pointing out how disrespectful or stupid key members of the Trump administration are is partisan BS that will not save a single college education, let alone remedy the desperate situation of our historically black colleges and universities. Right now, the heads of HBCUs have a historic opportunity to save their institutions by stirring up a movement from below for free tuition for HBCUs and for all public colleges and universities, for loan forgiveness for students at public universities, for interest reductions for all students, and for getting the federal government out of the student loan business. Free college tuition is not an impractical pie in the sky. Germany does it, France does it, Norway and a dozen other countries do it. State universities in California and Louisiana did it for decades in the 20th century. Free tuition was a cornerstone demand of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign that earned him millions of votes. Free college education is what modern human societies do when they recognize that education is a public good, not a private privilege. A nominal tax on Wall Street and the reallocation of federal funds that now go to student lenders would easily pay for free tuition. HBCUs were founded with white philanthropy beginning in the 1860s because the newly freed black population urgently needed teachers and other professionals, and because white colleges rarely admitted black students. Black student access was still being litigated in the United States 9 decades later, and to this day, HBCUs produce a far greater percentage of highly competent black college grads than other institutions. But the leaders of our historically black colleges and universities have largely failed to envision ways to fund their institutions outside of white philanthropy and the occasional special government funding initiative directed exclusively at them. The United Negro College Fund has even accepted Koch brothers' money with many nasty strings attached. It's time to stop digging that hole deeper. There are historic currents in motion right now. Millions of college grads, not just black ones, are crushed by unpayable student debt and by lack of opportunities, and they have proven receptive to the idea of free college tuition. It's a movement waiting to be galvanized. The Trump administration won't much like it any more than Hillary Clinton did. but free college tuition for HBCUs and public institutions is something that can be accomplished in a decade or so of agitation and struggle, if our HBCU college presidents are truly leaders and not followers. This is a current they can tap into. Of course, the common wisdom is that nobody is more conservative than a black college president. It's a stereotype some of them will have to violate to save their institutions and to save the very idea of education as a public good, not a private privilege. If the first black president did not save HBCUs, nothing Donald Trump is willing to give out will do the trick either. It's time to really bargain, to demand what is not being offered. And if our historically black college presidents lack the political vision and the intestinal fortitude to do it, maybe we need to start this movement without them. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon. Find us on the web at www.blackagendareport.com.
On death row, with no death sentence. For several years now, well over a decade, the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections kept dozens of men on death row even though they didn't have a pending death sentence. These men, held at the state's death rows in Greene County and Greaterford, were people who had their death sentences overturned by a state or federal court and held in solitary confinement for months and years until two men filed suits against this long-standing DOC practice. Craig Williams of Greene and Sean T. Walker of Greaterford filed separate civil actions in federal court challenging this procedure, but both men initially lost. Both men began their actions by filing their suits pro se or without a lawyer, and both filed appeals before the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, where both men prevailed. The Federal Appeals Court ruled in a February 9, 2007 opinion that the continued detention of men in solitary confinement who had no pending death sentences was violative of a state-created liberty interest under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Williams spent 6 years on death row without a death sentence. Walker spent 8 years on death row without a death sentence. In Williams versus Secretary, DOC, the Third Circuit found this confinement unconstitutional, but also granted the DOC the defense that, until now, this right wasn't clearly established. The Williams decision, being the first of its kind, put the DOC on notice that such a practice was now per se unconstitutional and a violation of a prisoner's state-created liberty interest. Williams proved a talented jailhouse lawyer when he was on the row. He's been off death row since 2012, and he's still one hell of a jailhouse lawyer, still making new law. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And you can find those commentaries at Prison Radio. Just Google it. It comes up pretty quick. It's a fairly popular place, I guess. Or Google knows about it. An interesting juxtaposition. Schools, academia, and incarceration. How much money is spent to keep people locked up and how much money is spent to educate people. All right, I'll let you dwell on that because I want to keep moving here and hear Amy Goodman's commentary this week. She highlights the ACA. When I called in earlier, I made the joke about Ron Paul wandering around the Capitol with this, or I pointed at it, I didn't make the joke. He made the joke with his copier machine in tow. I don't know why he didn't have a little portable one. I guess it was better visuals to have one. Trying to find a copy of the ACA so the Senate could look at what the House was supposedly crafting, but it turns out a lot of the House members aren't even privy to this so-called solution. All right. There's a Resist Art event at the IMC. I have some association with the place. It's an interesting project for sure. And I've only seen some small, like, thumbnails of the artwork on Facebook, which you can do. Resist Art Show. Some of my favorite, one of my favorite groups is playing there. The band that plays Nino Rota and high Andean polkas and very odd things. 2 to 4, I guess 2 sets. 9 Knights of Cabiria, and then a band I haven't seen yet from 4 to 5, Coneflowers. I think that's kind of old timey stuff. And Sunset, I have no idea what that is. Maybe also associated a little bit with the C4A, the Center, Community Center for the Arts. This is in the IMC Gallery, the old post office building. We need a painter to get up there and, well, never mind. There's stuff here that on their Facebook page that I haven't been able to suss out yet. You can go there and find out some information. Should be a great event through the afternoon. It's going to be sunny but a bit breezy. So part of the gallery is very brightly lit, the famous sunroom. Okay, Almost Day, did I mention them yet? They have a show at the Iron Post, also in downtown Urbana. I guess there was a big event. It looked like it went really well. Some people were celebrating the benefit for Planned Parenthood. I didn't make it out to that last night. Lots of people playing. Paul Kottheimer apparently had something to do with pulling it together. 25 musical acts from 7 to 1. I'm wondering if people did some videos so I can be vicariously attending. It's for a Planned Parenthood fund. I forget what it's called here. The whole benefit was called Music in Action, if you want to find out about it. And it's Planned Parenthood Action Fund. So, all right. Try to drop in another couple of community announcements. Higher Ground, the Dynamic Duo, did a lot on the County Board convened forum presentations by the administrator and somebody in the budget, is it? Again, supposed to wear purple as part of the CARE campaign, which is, I'll endorse, but WEF doesn't endorse candidates or referendum. But there's a small increase in a tax. It's very small. That's on the ballot. And there's also provision to allow the county board to privatize it. Yes on one and no on the other, it seems to me. It's fallen out of favor to have these things, and most counties around the state do not have them. A county-level nursing home for the not necessarily indigent elderly, but some to some extent. So an important issue. You can inform yourself on it. And there's both a Champaign County CARE, I forget what the acronym stands for, Facebook page, and there's also a more traditional website, I guess, if that's a possible thing. Champaign County CARE, classified as a political organization. That's an April 4th vote. That's when the elections for mayor, which was also covered quite well. highlighting the crossover vote is the candidate for the mayor on the Republican side by voting in the Democratic primary, which technically should disqualify from him from running as a Republican. So whether wonders whether our county clerk Gordy Hulty will rule on that. I gather the state's attorney or DA Julia Reitz said, well, we shouldn't go ahead with perjury. There's apparently a perjurious implication of this when you attest in one election that you're Republican and then you vote in a Democratic primary. They are pretty open primaries, but this kind of never mind. I'm getting apoplectic here. Here's Amy Goodman.
Transplant cancer survivor takes on Donald Trump over Obamacare. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Donald Trump's first address to Congress was hailed by many as presidential, primarily because he didn't stray far from his prepared remarks on the teleprompter. Despite the pomp and ceremony of the joint session, Trump's delivery of his 5,000-word speech was replete with inaccuracies, mischaracterizations, and fabrications. While touted as his opportunity to unify the country, he instead rattled off a string of divisive policy prescriptions that are red meat to his base.
We want all Americans to succeed, but that can't happen in an environment of lawless chaos. We must restore integrity and the rule of law at our borders. For that reason, we will soon begin the construction of a great, great wall along our southern border. Finally, to keep America safe, we must provide the men and women of the United States military with the tools they need to prevent war. If they must, they have to fight, and they only have to win. I am sending Congress a budget that rebuilds the military, eliminates the defense sequester, and calls for one of the largest increases in national defense spending in American history.
Among the guests in the chamber as he spoke was a remarkable 26-year-old African-American woman. Her name, Ola Ojuwumi. She was seated in the gallery in her wheelchair. Ola is alive today, she says, because of the Affordable Care Act. Donald Trump spoke about what he called the imploding Obamacare disaster.
Tonight, I am also calling on this Congress to repeal and replace Obamacare. With reforms that expand choice, increase access, lower costs, and at the same time provide better health care. Mandating every American to buy government-approved health insurance was never the right solution for our country. Obamacare is collapsing, and we must act decisively to protect all Americans. Action is not a choice, it is a necessity. So I am calling on all Democrats and Republicans in Congress to work with us to save Americans from this imploding Obamacare disaster.
But the law has led to an increase of over 20 million people obtaining health insurance.
It was quite scary when I heard his comments about the Affordable Care Act.
That's Ola Ojuwumi speaking to us on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
I personally was affected. I am the survivor of a heart and kidney transplant, and I was able to receive insurance and stay on my parents' insurance until I was 26.
Ola had the transplants when she was 11 years old, and her parents' health insurance company tried to boot her off the plan several times. As a result of the transplant, she must take immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of her life. Having recently beaten post-transplant lymphoma, she is a cancer survivor as well. Despite all Ola has had to overcome personally, her main focus is helping others.
I get strength from my community and seeing the problems in the world. I knew I was meant to do social justice when in recent months I've watched the news and literally been brought down to tears about the way America is headed and about the regressions.
In college, Ola Ojuwumi founded Project Ascend with a $500 tuition refund check. The group's mission? To create higher education opportunities for marginalized and disadvantaged young people across the globe. Many of the Democratic congresswomen wore white to the Trump speech, echoing the dress style of the American suffragettes a century ago.
I had on my white jacket and a red dress, and I was proud to see women standing up for what's right and standing in solidarity. It's really remarkable how much power we have as women in understanding that our voices will be heard even if we aren't the majority. I'm proud of Women on the Hill championing for our rights and championing for Planned Parenthood. They provide a voice for voiceless populations, including women of color and women with disabilities.
Ola has volunteered with Planned Parenthood, handing out condoms in the annual Gay Pride Parade in Washington, D.C.
Planned Parenthood's work in passing the ACA and the ACA having a free birth control option allowed for women with disabilities like me to receive free birth control. And we aren't included in the discussion. Women with disabilities, we have the highest rates of sexual assault, and we are more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted than able-bodied women. And so Planned Parenthood Metro Washington gave women like me a voice and taught me how to really protest and advocate on behalf of my group.
Ola is also critical of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who said during her confirmation hearings that implementation of the federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, also known as the IDEA Act, should be left to the states, opening the potential that states could discriminate against students with disabilities.
It showed a lack of understanding about equal access to education.
Ola Ojuwumi has been through a lot, but clearly has much more to do.
My message to young activists is continue to advocate. Draw inspiration from what you see. Don't change the channel. Don't ignore what's going on in the world. Watch what makes you angry so it can keep you fired up and keep you in the trenches fighting, because change does not just get done on the Hill. It gets done with your voices and your advocacy. So continue to go to these town halls and speak out about the ACA and why we need it. Continue to speak out about anti-Semitism, anti-blackness, Islamophobia, all of that. And be sure to be inclusive of your movements. Particularly, 50% of police brutality victims are people with disabilities. Our rights and our images are not in the forefront, whether it be the sexual assault, anti-campus rape movement, or, you know, Black Lives Matter. They've done influential work, but we need representation because people with disabilities, people in wheelchairs, our rights matter, too. And we need to be included in the discussion. So make sure your movements are inclusive of everyone from every background. And, well, you know, we can really change the world together.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Oh, let's see. Someone just called and wanted to know about a community service announcement that happened last Monday. Well, there is a public service announcement. I call them community service announcements, but maybe that's ambiguous because when you call it a CSA, people think you're about talking about community-supported agriculture. Not that that's a bad thing. But so if that gentleman wants to go to the WEFT website and look for PSAs, he might be able to find the one that he was looking for. I really couldn't deal with it at this point. All right, enough of that. We're about halfway through, and I've got about another couple hours of programming to play. So mentioned Gareth Porter. Probably get to that segment about the white helmets tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock. More of an international thing. Though this is a bit of an international thing, and it's about a somewhat overlooked was an executive order, an EO, one of the early Intercepted podcasts had a piece on the history of the EOs, executive orders, and it was a curious thing. They aren't mentioned in the Constitution, so there's no category for that in the Chapter 1. So it's just our own common law, I guess. Not going back to British common law. Or maybe it is an edict of the monarch. I don't know. That was argued in the Supreme Court under the Nixon era that by English common law, the executive has some monarchical. Really, I can't make this stuff up. All right, this is from an excerpt from a program that Pacifica circulates called TaxCast. It comes from the UK. There is a taxjustice.net.uk, I believe. There's a tax justice locally, and I mentioned it because also wanted to mention the rebroadcast this coming Wednesday of Jackson Potter, former, well, he's an alumni. He made a great joke about how everybody was wearing AFSCME green when they heard that he was going to be talking about labor on campus at the University YMCA, the Friday Forum. Talking about the state of labor in Illinois, so obviously some of it grim, some of it promising. He's with Chicago's Teachers Union. I commend it to your attention this coming Wednesday. Urbana Public Television also has some of it. And he spent a lot of time talking about tax fairness, which is a union issue, right? And there's a claim that Illinois doesn't have any money, being a wealthy industrial state with the lowest personal income tax. That's likely true because Indiana effectively has a higher income tax, personal income tax, than Illinois now, because they have a county-level income tax that's executed in most of the more populous counties. So most people in Indiana pay a lower rate now, a higher rate now than Illinoisans pay, which doesn't have a county tax assessment. Maybe we should copy the Hoosiers on that one. All right, but this is about large multinational corporations, and particularly the U.S. Flavored ones. They really don't have any allegiance to any nation state. Some of them bigger than many nation states. There are a couple other segments on this that are quite interesting. I think you can get the podcast to yourself, but I get it through AudioPort, program of Pacifica, and I'll just barely have time for material from what I'm calling Trumperland, episode 6 or 7 of The Intercepted, which ends with a discussion with some ex-CIA people who are going on the record, not talking about deep state or anything like that. Talking about leaks, and it's pretty engaging stuff. I already excerpted it to not play through to the end, but customized intelligence. They don't mention when Robert Gates was ordered by Bush 1 to develop a different assessment of the then Soviet Union, and contradicted what analysts like Ray McGovern were producing at the time, that they weren't the threat that they needed to be to serve the military-industrial complex's avaricious demands for more and more federal dollar, which we're seeing it being enacted now, as it were. Opinions, of course, of those as a speaker, as I generally do that at the beginning, but we're going to do it at the half. In a half hour or so, we'll crank up the CU Progressive News. There's a bunch of community announcements in it, including one that I couldn't find anything about, and I've forgotten what it is, but in the middle of it, there's some community announcements of some events going on, including the reprising the one of the nursing home on Monday at the Brookings Center. But here's a little bit from the UK. Everything sounds more authoritative in the accent, doesn't it? Except the Queen.
A leak like the Panama Papers risks exposing them. Those are the news headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, this month, one of Donald Trump's main priorities was to sign a law which rolls back anti-corruption regulation designed to combat what is basically revenue theft from the poor, really, in the poorest countries in the world, illicit financial flows coming out of those countries.
Yes, so President Trump chose Valentine's Day to sign off on his really first significant piece of legislation, which is a law that rolls back on a really important anti-corruption provision in the Dodd-Frank Act that requires companies in the extractive industries, that's oil and gas and the mining companies and such like, to disclose the payments they make to governments.
Remember that some of the oil companies in other countries are legally bound to disclose their payments to governments in 30 other countries. So this does give companies like ExxonMobil a foot up in the race, and they've long complained that this pesky regulation put them at a competitive disadvantage when they're making deals, when they're up against state-owned companies from Russia and China.
No matter how hard I try to understand why the president wants to get rid of one of the most important anti-corruption measures of the past decade, I can't see this as anything other than a huge gift to big oil. and a huge gift to corrupt kleptocrats and to their business cronies more generally. Some people have tried to spin this measure as an attempt to make the United States firms more competitive, to make United States oil companies more competitive. And while it's true that the US did lead the way in strengthening disclosure requirements by multinational companies, the vast majority of major oil companies and mining companies around the world now have to comply with similar transparency measures in other countries. So this step by President Trump is nothing other than a major step backwards. And as one US senator has described it, this is a Valentine's gift to kleptocrats and corrupt businesses in the United States and around the world.
Yeah, and I should mention that the Secretary of State for Trump is Rex Tillerson, who was chairman and chief executive of ExxonMobil.
And, of course, has had a lot of experience in negotiation with Russian businesses and with the Russian government. And, of course, they'll be only too pleased that transparency provisions like this are removed because, let's face it, so much of what happens around Russian oil and gas happens in complete secrecy.
The European Union Commission has made a statement saying it hasn't got any plans to join this race to the bottom by re-regulating over their transparency rules. And a lot of the oil companies would say, well, not to worry because the US Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is still in place. But that's a very inadequate piece of legislation, isn't it? Doesn't cover half of what needs to be covered.
And that is the problem, of course, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It's so targeted at bribery, and this is not the same as bribery. The whole host of other factors involved here, including tax evasion and similar, this has opened the field for a much wider variety of corrupt practices. And one can well imagine the oil lobbies will now start concentrating on the European Union, and they'll be saying we have to compete in this race to the bottom with the United States companies, otherwise we'll be at a competitive disadvantage. And that raises questions. What is that competitive disadvantage? Well, it's a competitive disadvantage which stops us from acting as criminals.
Nice.
I thought it was brilliant. I love that joke. That's a nice competitive advantage to be criminals. So I've been playing stuff and talking about stuff and posting stuff on various sites about how I'm skeptical of the truism now in the media, the commonplace that Russia has hacked the election. That doesn't mean I don't think there isn't a lot of oligarchic and corrupt money in the tax or the financial schemes of the current POTUS. It's probably thick of it. Son brags about all the Russian money, and then they turn around and say, well, we didn't deal with Russia. But if the Russians have their money in the city of London and their oligarchs are there, it doesn't really sort of matter. They're all pretty transnational too, right? So I don't know whether we'll find out much about this, but that removal of transparency sort of might be helpful in obscuring the details, I guess. The other reason why I think that Trump doesn't release his tax and more financial details like he ought to is because his wealth is built on chimera and scheming and lots of debt, and he probably would net out to below zero. I think he's probably still operating in a bankrupt sort of, been bailed out by Russian oligarchs and by Saudi princes. When you have to go to a Saudi prince to help bail out a casino, you wonder. All right, opinions again are those of the speakers. One of my opinions about the speech this Monday, which I did endure to the joint, actually no, I was out at some jazz, I just caught up on it later, come to think of it. I didn't suffer it live and in person, other than the fact that there were like 22 fact-checkable items where he was totally misrepresenting, if not using the other more colloquial Anglo-Saxon word for it. I was struck by the use of the widow of the Navy SEAL, and what I was struck by is he was counting the length of the ovation as it was happening. He's a record breaker or something like it. So he's got the sociopathic sensibility of a reality TV show, even when he's talking about death and grieving widows. It's sad. All right. Illustrating some of that, maybe, is this segment from the very creative Jeremy Scale and group, and using the voice of a Arab American guy, apparently, maybe he's Iranian American, to voice Trump in Wonderland.
I had a world of my own, everything would be nonsense. Nothing would be what it is, because everything would be what it isn't. And contrariwise, what it is, it wouldn't be. And what it wouldn't be, it would. You see?
Absurdities. It was a fabulous press conference.
In my world, you wouldn't say,
my gosh, we've done more work in 1 month than the prior administration did in 6 months.
Oh, but you would. You'd say,
based upon my experience, there isn't any disorder, any chaos.
Why, in my world, one
fantasy.
This is fake news. It doesn't matter. Distortions, it's fabricated.
That's the reality.
Your representation is just wishful thinking.
It doesn't work. And we are again in this world.
I keep wishing it could be that way, because my world would be a wonderland.
This is Intercepted.
I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 6 of Intercepted.
Each American generation passes the torch of truth, liberty, and justice in an unbroken chain all the way down to the present. That torch is now in our hands, and we will use it to light up the world.
Well, seeing Donald Trump address a joint session of the United States Congress felt like an awkward yet very disturbing class trip to the Capitol, where every kid gets to pretend they're a senator or a congressman or the president, and they take a picture on the House floor that they can show their parents or their grandparents. Except the kid at the podium? Yeah, he's the president of the most powerful nation on earth. We certainly are on a trip, a very bad trip. And one that's already having grave consequences both in the U.S. and across the globe.
I am sending Congress a budget that rebuilds the military, eliminates the defense sequester, and calls for one of the largest increases in national defense spending in American history.
Whoever wrote Trump's speech at the Capitol may be trying to roll out a softer, more responsible Trump operating system, the soft serve Trump. But this is all kabuki theater. And I'm going to leave that to the pundits, the politicians, the news shows to deal with. Donald Trump likes to portray himself as the great promoter and defender of America, its strongest supporter of law enforcement and the U.S. military. He's promising a massive, some in his circle say unprecedented, expansion in the U.S. military budget, while at the same time gutting social spending. Trump loves to talk about his generals. But listen to how Trump talks about the death of William Ryan Owens, an elite U.S. Navy SEAL who died in the utterly disastrous raid that Trump authorized while having dinner with his son-in-law and Steve Bannon last month in Yemen.
Well, this was a mission that was started before I got here. This was something that was, just they wanted to do. They came to see me. They explained what they wanted to do. The generals, who are very respected. My generals are the most respected that we've had in many decades, I believe. And they lost Ryan.
This is so f***ed up on so many levels. First of all, upwards of 30 Yemeni civilians, including many women and an infant, were killed in this raid. Success? The U.S. military doesn't dispute that a large number of civilians were killed, yet Trump keeps calling it this huge success. But second, did you hear how Trump blamed the U.S. Navy SEAL's death on the generals? It's amazing. Trump wants to be commander-in-chief when it's convenient for his reality show White House or on the campaign trail. But when an elite soldier dies, oh, well, the generals lost him.
And Ryan is looking down right now. You know that. And he's very happy because I think he just broke a record.
Now, for his part, the father of that Navy SEAL, Bill Owens, refused to meet with Trump. He said, quote, "Why at this time did there have to be this stupid mission when it wasn't even barely a week into his administration? Why? For 2 years prior, there were no boots on the ground in Yemen. Everything was missiles and drones because there was not a target worth one American life. Now, all of a sudden, we had to make this grand display." Now, Trump maintains that the raid was a success. And White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer says they're going to conduct 3 separate military reviews.
"I just spoke to our great General Mattis just now, who reconfirmed that, and I quote, Ryan was a part of a highly successful raid that generated large amounts of vital intelligence that will lead to many more victories in the future against our enemy."
This Yemen horror show raises what I think is one of the most urgent questions that we as journalists need to be asking constantly. How will we ever know if anything this White House or this president himself says is true? They lie. They lie constantly. They lie about little things. They lie about big things. They're addicted to the narcotic of lying, and it's infectious among their supporters. It's one thing to call CNN fake news and to chastise the New York Times. That's all extremely disturbing, of course. But what is to stop Trump and his team from expanding their universe of alternative facts into a world of alternative intelligence? This week, George W. Bush won praise from liberals and conservatives alike for his mild criticisms of Trump and his totally hypocritical defense of the news media's role in our democracy.
"I consider the media to be indispensable to democracy. That we need an independent media to hold people like me to account. I mean, power can be very addictive, and it can be corrosive, and it's important for the media to call to account people who abuse their power."
I'm not going to join in the chorus of praise for George W. Bush just because he tosses some cotton balls of criticism at Trump. This man was responsible for the deaths of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people across the globe, and thousands of American troops. He served as the head of what was basically a criminal syndicate of war criminals and torture, while masquerading as a compassionate conservative. There's good reason, though, to bring up George W. Bush in the context of Trump. Bush's wars relied on what we now call alternative facts. That's how the Iraq War was sold. That was how the Patriot Act was passed. That was how these endless wars were justified over and over and over. Bush and Dick Cheney, yeah, they were a bit more sophisticated than Trump and Bannon and, you know, their team appear to be. But we can already see that same machinery that brought us the Iraq War playing out with Trump and his team. It's one thing to lie in all caps on Twitter. It's another to manipulate intelligence. I'm joined now by 2 people who know a lot about this. They both worked on sensitive operations within the U.S. intelligence community under George W. Bush's administration. Clint Watts was a U.S. Army infantry officer who was then recruited after 9/11 to become an FBI special agent on the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Watts also served as the executive director of the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. Neda Bakos was a career CIA analyst. She found herself actually working on the program to find a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. And she was working on that as a result of pressure from the Bush White House, particularly Dick Cheney, on the CIA. That connection, of course, was never substantiated. I want to welcome both you, Clint Watts, and you, Neda Bakos, to Intercepted. Clint Watts, let's begin with you. What's your read on Trump's approach to the CIA, the military, and intelligence operations in general?
The Trump strategy is to build allegiance by fawning on law enforcement and the military, the way he's done so far, to try and bring them in so that they're loyal and adherent to him in ways that the Obama administration failed. And then at the same point, to drive a wedge between the intelligence community and much of the military and law enforcement, which was very typical of General Flynn, you know, the first national security advisor. He butted heads straight on with the CIA and even other parts of the Defense Department, parts of law enforcement community. So I think the initial strategy was to defang the intel community, then sort of say, okay, you know, I'll listen to you and, you know, I'll come to you a little bit, and then to continue to drive that wedge and then pump up the military and law enforcement. And it's backfired, I think, to a certain degree. And I think at a higher level, what the public doesn't see is there are competing strains inside each of these organizations. So in the Department of Defense, there are those that are very excited about a Trump administration because they feel they've been, you know, a little bit underhanded by the Obama administration. I think within the intel community, it's much more balanced, and they're not as enthusiastic about it because the president doesn't accept information that's against his views. It literally is his presidential daily brief he doesn't take. He doesn't take the intel briefings. He only wants the intelligence that fits a certain filter. For anyone that's a bona fide intelligence expert, those are the worst things that you ever want to hear. It's also an opportunity, though. I think the smarter people in the intelligence community are going to treat him like a dictator. And what do you do with a dictator? You play to his ego. So they will end up almost influencing the president like a foreign adversary, I think, that if they want to convince him of what they believe the truth or a balanced assessment for America is, they're going to end up treating him like a Gaddafi or a Putin or somebody that they want to appeal to. And they're literally going to have to make their assessments with the information behind it, come to terms with the president's worldview, which is very frightening because it really sets up a lot of blind spots as well.
There's a lot of discussion now in the media of you know, what's called the deep state, and also this notion that the CIA and certain sectors of the FBI are trying to undermine the legitimacy of Donald Trump's presidency. Then on the other side, saying that the CIA and other agencies may not actually be providing President Trump with the full picture on an intelligence level because they don't trust him. What do you say to that?
I think what will be the tell about this division inside these organizations when you see words of alternative intelligence process or alternative analysis process, which I imagine will happen. If you remember back during
What does that mean?
If you remember back during the Bush administration when it was time to build the case for war in Iraq, there was certain segments in the Department of Defense that were coming up with their own independent assessments of the justifications to go to war in Iraq. And those oftentimes competed and were contrarian to what you got out of the intelligence community. So if this administration really wants to push a certain agenda, and we've already seen this now with the DHS intel assessment around the ban in these countries, they produced a report that didn't match up with this policy that they're pushing. So now you see the administration say, well, I'm not going to listen to it. We're still going to push it forward. Maybe we need to go back to the drawing board and do analysis. What I would expect them to do is start to put together alternative teams out of the White House that are going to provide another competitive look at these questions. And if we see that, especially in the Department of Defense or run directly out of the National Security Council, I would have great concern. That to me would signal I don't trust my intel agencies, and the intel I want is to support my actions is the following: go find it. And that happened, if you remember back during the Bush administration, where there was this alternative intelligence process, which was coming out sideways against the intel community. So that's very nerve-wracking to me.
Well, and just to provide people the historical context for that, you had Stephen Cambone, who was one of Rumsfeld's top deputies, who ran what they called the Office of Special Plans, and Cambone and other of minions or representatives of Rumsfeld were doing what's called stovepiping. They were taking raw bits of intelligence and cherry picking them to support a conclusion rather than letting the facts lead to a conclusion. And Neda, you served at during this time at the CIA, where you had this parallel operation being run out of the Pentagon while the CIA was tasked with determining, are these things true? Are they not? What does the evidence look like? And then you had Cambone and others running around cherry picking intelligence and providing it directly to the vice president. Could we see something like that replay under Trump, Neda?
So under the Office of Special Plans, as you mentioned, Doug Feith was involved. Paul Wolfowitz was involved. Their findings were the opposite of basically what we were finding at the time. I was on the team charged with figuring out whether or not Iraq had anything to do with 9/11 and Al-Qaeda. Now, that question did not come up organically through the intelligence we were collected. That question came up from the administration. We weren't seeing indicators. We wouldn't have formed a team otherwise to evaluate this information. So that in and of itself was the beginning of backwards, you know, cart before the horse. We came to our conclusion. We delivered it to the White House, to Congress. The DOD did have a very different opinion on how they characterized relationships between Saddam and other terrorist organizations. They weighed false information. They also took raw reports and cherry-picked those from sources that we didn't deem reliable and gave those to the president. It's very clear that politicizing intelligence and cherry-picking information that you think is going to support your bottom line, you know, it led to war in this instance.
One of the most worrisome things that emerges from the thick intelligence file we have on Iraq's biological weapons is the existence of mobile production facilities used to make biological agents. Let me take you inside that intelligence file and share with you what we know from eyewitness accounts.
That was a little stab from the past from The Intercepted. You can find that. It's a podcast. You can. They actually recommend Jeremy Scahill, the Interlocker tour there with those two spooky people. He has good relations with a lot of them. I guess that's how he gets his stuff. And they were willing to go on the record. It recommends you get it through iTunes and write a view on iTunes, because apparently that helps get more listeners. I'm trying to pump it up. I'm finding it's quite good. It doesn't always come out to an hour, and it doesn't always pass FCC prohibitions. They get very excited and use expletives. I took only one out of today's show. Today's segment when they were doing the Trumperland thing. I guess I'm going to just mention a couple of other of the events, as well as a week Monday, the forum that Carol Ammons, our state rep, was talking about in an earlier show, where Scott Bennett, our Senate representative in Springfield, will have a joint thing in a couple of weeks, or in a week Monday. This Monday, there is this, this is tomorrow afternoon. Here I was riffing the Monday thing. The Monday thing, most eminent Monday, is this Champaign County presentation on the two provisions on the ballot regarding the nursing home. One, small tax increase, and the other one allowing the county board to privatize it if they so choose. Well, the other thing I was trying to get to in highlighting the fact that we do have state reps who are coming forth and meeting with the people. Rodney Davis is refusing to have a town meeting here. He had this phoning it in thing with selected questions, I'm sure. In lieu of this formal series of in-person town halls, a nonpartisan group of constituents across the 13th Congressional District have organized a series of town hall events, and one of them is tomorrow afternoon. If you want to rail against him, I'm sure the flat Rodney will be there. Maybe you can get a selfie. That's 2 to 3:30 at the Champaign Station, which used to be called the Illinois Terminal Building. I guess people decided that was not the best language to describe it. That's the new train station, bus station, intermodal unit in downtown Champaign. It's usually up on the top floor or something where they have these activity centers. A good addition, I think, to the area, personally. All right, it's already 11 o'clock. Time goes by. I want to play a minute-long underwriting announcement. I haven't heard this one. This is a crew that does painting, and they're dropping their name here in the mix at for WEFT, so appreciate that.